Hey, it's been a little while since we caught up with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for a Tacky Talk. How are you, Tacky?
Hey, Joe, it's good to see you. Things aren't bad, and I understand people were able to get away for a bit during around the Labor Day time period. I hope people had a chance to time to unwind.
Yeah, it was kind of the first good weather holiday weekend all year, really.
I'm not that old, but I do tell people I've never seen it this wet and this hot this often.
So true. Yeah, I'm just waiting for the bumper crop of mosquitoes to bloom.
Well, as I told you, I live right across from the Black Creek Estuary, so I'm deep in marshland here, so I know a lot about mosquito bites.
Yeah, I am sure. Things starting to get active again on Beacon Hill, I'm guessing.
Slowly but steadily. I mean, I still ran public hearings in August. We ran a public hearing last Monday. I'm having one next week and a week after and a week after. Actually, on Tuesday, we're going down to Senator Sue Moran's district on the Cape to visit some businesses and talk about the impact of COVID on restaurants and other types of business in the area as part of a committee tour. My co-chair, you know, would like to the members to see firsthand what's going on. So it's going to be a bit of a day trip for the committee to be hosted by my co-chair to to have more chats with people, but this time really on the ground.
Yeah, what do you make about? I mean, there's still, I'm hearing this worker shortage, even though the federal benefits have come to an end. But businesses are still struggling. Places like restaurants and retail stores, especially.
Yeah, I talked to the Restaurant Association president yesterday, Bob Lutz, oddly enough, as you asked that question.
Yeah.
And he confirms that particularly hospitality has had a hard time in hiring. It is very much a competitive market for hiring hospitality, especially restaurant workers. It is a competitive rate right now to do so. We all agree as well that some of these folks didn't want to wait for the job to return. They didn't know if they had a job to go back to. Because of the closure of the restaurants and other hospitality industries, there was that uncertainty. So why sit around waiting for unemployment benefits, realizing no place to go?
Mm.
And that's part of it. Another reason is because we want career changes. Mm-hmm. Unemployment periods, doesn't matter what unemployment period of any decade, you see a lot of people going back to school or getting a professional license or decide it's time to make a move because by circumstances, it forces you into thinking that maybe you should have a life change. That is actually not unusual. It does happen very often during recessionary periods. COVID is just different because of the healthcare component.
Mm.
And also a personal health issue. I mean, a lot of folks that work in these industries may have a lot of other issues, whether it be at home or with themselves. And some of the folks that probably aren't returning may have underlying health conditions or caring for people with underlying health conditions and working in a highly exposed public environment, regardless of your mask and hand sanitizing and even distancing. There's only so much space that you can have between people. And I do notice that restaurants that I've been to have been maintaining some degree of social distancing tables the best they can. They kept a lot of different partitions to keep the customers safe from each other as best they can. But if you're in a high exposure environment, that also improves your risk. And we don't have vaccine mandate cards at all going to restaurants or any public place. So like riding the T, which is people have hesitancy on, you don't know if the person next to you is vaccinated or infected.
Right.
And you don't know if your wait staff is vaccinated or infected. You do not know when you're standing in line for a table or someone comes over and coughs on you because the air is dry and maybe they're infected or not. You do not know. And this is kind of the other factor that's impacting particularly front-facing jobs is the lack of knowledge of whether or not the person you interact with can be a carrier. And as we've also now discovered with the Delta variant, even though you are vaccinated, you can still be a carrier.
Mm-hmm.
This was not the instance with the original virus nor with Alpha, where you're vaccinated, but you your viral load can't get high enough to become a carrier if you've been infected. It appears still, data may change in another week because it seems like every time I talk about this, the data changes in a week.
Right.
know, you could still be a carrier despite the fact you feel perfectly well. And this is the problem with early COVID as well. A lot of healthy folks are running around with COVID, spreading it around, but they had little to no symptoms.
Yeah. I wonder too about the impact that the women in the workplace, you know, have had on the worker shortage. Of course, they had to be home with their children. I think the federal child care tax credit is still in effect. So I'm wondering if that too has something to do with it. That's a lot of women who work in the hospitality industry. There may be that shortage there too.
Yeah, workers in general have been very badly impacted by the school closures, not because of coming, schools are not daycare services, okay?
Right.
I'm not calling it that. But, it's a part of your routine of your day work life. And being at home with your kids online, doing school work while trying to get your day job done as a white-collar worker, you know, people do not have to actually go visit someplace, which was challenging. Now, if you have a front-facing job, and particularly things like supermarkets, construction, healthcare, and there's a lot of other types of jobs that do not cannot do what we're doing now on this screen.
Right.
You know, the lack of school puts them in a bind, because let's say you have your mother or father would normally come in substitute, let's say on a snow day or perhaps a holiday when there's no school. That is not an option in COVID. You know, you got a 70-year-old mom or dad, and you don't want to come in and have them take care of the kids for a day. They're retired. That is not really a strong option.
Right.
And then you have a multi-family situation. I've never heard of a situation more than once. You have multi-generational families, and the front-facing worker, whether it be a supermarket, retail, construction, doesn't matter, brings home the virus, and then you have three generations of infections. So, these are things I think those of us that live in a virtual world don't truly understand. That if you have one or two kids or three kids or how many children, you're a front-facing worker, you don't have a choice, you're a wage worker in particular, there's no salary, you don't have a lot of sick time, vacation time, and you're maybe making, just above minimum wage to get by, and you have multiple people in a family working and you need multiple generations of people trying to take care of the family, your risk level goes up considerably. And that forces those folks to really have to reconsider where they can find other types of work that has a reduced level of front facing.
Mm. What do you make of the president's vaccine mandate, Jackie, for employers with 100 workers or more?
And so I had a friend of mine ask me about this regarding the impact on his business. I told him we've done this before. It's called Obamacare or the ACA. Mm. I mean, Baker has also implemented the provision regarding a fee that businesses have to pay if their employees are not insured in their insurance program, which it's a little quirky because I'm like, what if you're insured under your spouse's insurance? That means you don't need to take the insurance of the business you're in. So that's like another conversation. That's a different conversation.
Okay.
But, this is something that the state and the federal government has the power to do. And, people are like, oh, it's unconstitutional. Well, the Supreme Court did uphold the ACA.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Yes, that's right.
So yeah, this is a federal power, folks. I mean, you can sit on the other side of the screen and tell me I'm wrong, but do remember the ACA was held up twice by Supreme Court with Trump appointees. This was not a liberal court that upheld the ACA.
Interesting.
So this federal power is there for now that it can do that. And I'm sure employers are frustrated about that. But again, I also have trouble not believing that employers would like to have a COVID spread in their workplace and have them shut down. And then, of course, everybody knows about it. And no one's going to come visit your business because you got to be tagged with negative idea that you're a super spreader because people talk. So, I get it. There's a whole degree of, personal liberty, and they don't feel like they have to police the employees. Professions, they actually kind of do, particularly if you work in healthcare, especially infectious diseases. But this is actually kind of a quirky situation. And, if people took more personal responsibility about taking care of other people or by themselves, we would not have to discuss things like mandates.
Yeah, it's a tricky, it's a shaky argument too, because the vaccines are free. They can't claim any kind of financial obligation or exemption because they're free.
And there's such a high vaccination rate of people out there over the course of the past year, of between the clinical tests plus real world. People that are vaccinated, you have questions about it, ask them how they feel. I mean, I just don't understand how you can't just talk to somebody. So how are you doing? You've been vaccinated. I've been thinking about it. I don't know what to say.
Speaker Mariano is running into the same concern, talking about a possible mandate at the State House.
Absolutely. I mean, the Speaker of the House actually can mandate House staff to be vaccinated. House membership is a little bit trickier because we're all independently elected by our own individual bodies. He can implement a mandate on the House membership, I think. I presume he can. This is one of those things I don't have a real good answer for. There's no precedence, like I think, because for example, we can mandate dress code, for example.
Okay.
Right?
That's something you put on your body, not in your body.
That's correct. So we can't mandate behavior in the House.
So he could mandate a mask mandate, I suppose.
He can. We have done that.
Okay.
Whenever we're in session, we've required contact tracing. The few times I've gone to the building, I've done the contact tracing fellow sheet, as well as social distancing and all that stuff. So does that rise to the level that the House can mandate the elected members to be vaccinated? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I don't think anyone does right now. It's going to be untried territory.
Mm-hmm. I'm fairly confident he can mandate staff vaccinations. I'm fairly confident that he can do that.
Yeah. So there is no opening date as of yet, right?
No, Delta really has, again, threw this whole thing into a loop. It was still doing even Alpha.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're like, okay, we're ready to go, but we're not. And then, another thing that kind of set us back a little bit was Mayor Janey's mask mandate in Boston. It sent negative ripples to the entire business community about whether or not it should fully reopen, which again led to a delay of pretty much every business out there to perhaps open October and some even next year, which has huge negative impact in downtown Boston and the businesses and the restaurants and the retail because nobody's there. They're dependent on the workforce from outside the city to support them.
Yes, yeah.
And that's not happening right now. This is ripple effect. And we'll see, how the governor and the rest of the state government operates regarding, state employees coming back in, those who can come back in, how they also manage those who aren't vaccinated.
We talk a little bit about the pandemic relief funds, Jackie, and have they been received by the state? Have they been allocated by the state? Do you know?
Well, the so-called federal monies, was it ARA, APA? I can't remember anymore.
Yeah, the American Rescue Plan, I think, yeah.
And then we call that ARA again, like back during the Great Recession.
Oh, right, like yes, yeah.
I think we're just recycling names now. it's sitting in a trust fund. Ways and Means of conducting hearings as well as informational sessions for its membership to discuss ways they could spend the money and people's requests for money. Obviously, I've been getting emails sent in of every known group I didn't even know they existed.
It's like when that uncle hits the lottery that you never had touch with before, right?
All those family members you didn't know existed before, right?
Exactly.
So I'm getting like hit. I'm like, who are these people? I never seen before. So, people are looking at it. This is, again, a three-year plan of disbursement. It's right. Like a one deal. It's not like the cities and towns. They have to unload the money in one fiscal cycle.
Yeah, yeah.
We're a three-year plan with the submit to the feds for them to look at.
Right.
So it's kind of chugging on slowly. I mean, I know the governor's been impatient because he wants to take control of it and push it out. But from our standpoint, we're watching things unfold. On multiple levels, not just on the economic jobs level, but also looking at where we go on infrastructure, because part of money can go to infrastructure and things like broadband, which particularly if you're west or south of Quincy, far west and far south, you have broadband problems. As we all discovered when we do interviews with people from Western Mass, so you do people from the Cape, watch our public hearings, it's a little spottier Let's put it that way.
Yeah, made it challenging for sure. Yep.
Yeah, so it's a little different. So there's, you know, questions about which communities we need to make those investments like broadband in. And of course, there's a healthcare component. And, you know, our healthcare system is, you know, robust, and it's been strained and almost buckled twice during COVID. I don't think the public realizes like how close it became that if you had a heart attack, you're going to just die at home. There was no place to put you. And that's what you're seeing in places like Louisiana. And if you have a heart attack, you're dying at home.
Right.
There's literally no place to send. So, I mean, we've claimed close to buckling twice. And I think the public doesn't appreciate exactly how close we've come.
Yeah, it really hasn't been talked about in urgent detail at all. You're right.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've got to figure it out as we go along about how to spend this money. But I don't expect us to rush into spending it.
No, it might be wise to keep some, you know, in reserve. We don't really know what future variants hold or what impact there is to come. Yeah.
And there's also the unemployment trust fund. I mean, we're trying to figure out how much of that money we can put in the unemployment trust fund, because if we can, it actually reduces the pressure on businesses to replenish the fund, which has been essentially depleted since last October. It's been almost a full year since we depleted. It still continues being depletion, because as businesses come back online and pay into the fund, it's going back out as quickly as it goes in. Because it just hasn't have time to store.
Yeah. Plus all the fraud. I mean, I know they're trying to recoup the money that was, you know, lost in some fraudulent claims. Is that working, or is that still ongoing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're a cyber crime, there's no way we're going to get it back.
Right. It's gone. Yeah.
If you're a person that, you know, didn't put the application correctly, or been, you know, working, you know, under the table and got caught, yeah, we're going to get that money back.
Yeah.
Right. The cyber criminals, let's be honest about this. I mean, you know, these people are fraudulent claims that use cyber crimes to hack the system. Sorry, folks. I mean, we're not going to find these guys.
That's it. Yep.
They hit and run. They come in, they hit, and they run.
Yep.
So, I mean, taxpayers, sadly, just going to have to bite the bullet now. And I can't tell anybody. I have no way to explain it otherwise.
Right. Yeah. You know, hopefully they put it back in the economy and, you know, go on a spending spree or something.
Yeah, maybe these criminals will go big, big spending. But unfortunately, I think they're in places like Russia.
I think you're right.
They're helping the Russian economy out instead.
Yeah.
So, I know, it's just sad. This is just reality, right?
Yeah.
So stay tuned.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the MBTA tacky?
Yeah, we can talk a little bit about that. I mean, people saw a tragedy, obviously saw a tragedy this week regarding rusted stairwell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What a crazy accident that was. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a preventable accident.
And all I could think of is they were putting all this time and energy into putting up fences and barriers and signs. If they'd just taken all that money and energy and fixed the stairs.
One would think at least tear down the stairs.
Well, right. Yeah.
One would think at least minimum, if the whole structure is gone, to tear it down. This continues to be a small example of the ineptitude of the team regarding capital maintenance.
Mm.
And over the decades of doing this, you know, the biggest criticism was we did a lot of expansion commuter rail. We never put any of that money that was expansion back into infrastructure.
And
doing the Green Line project, which is pretty much fairly paid for, actually, some of it. Extension, but that's all federally paid for, so it's not really your affairs doing that. So, you know, it's always been like, why we keep growing while we're you know, the capital needs more, need to be more improved. And people blame, you know, Greenbush Line and the Big Dig. It's a little more involved than that, but to be honest with you, people think it's like just one or two things. It's not. It's like a dozen different factors. Now you have, you know, Boston mayoral candidates wanting free MBTA.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. And I'm just like, are you kidding me? I mean, you know, they're already having a ridership problem. Now they have no expansion ridership ability. When pre-COVID, there was no way to expand seating. There was no way to create more space during rush hour periods to increase ridership. You know, and we have, and people want electric buses. People want hybrid buses. That costs money. I'm not against hybrid buses either, but, you know, that ain't cheap. And then same thing with a better cars. I mean, we still got a slight delay of getting a red line cars in, but I mean, that's past capital costs. On top of, you know, maintaining the rails and sadly things like staircases. You know, so this is going to be a continuation. I don't think it's going to end. I think it's going to continue a lot regarding key capital maintenance issues. and a constant political rhetoric and desire to make it free, cost nothing, and not have to worry about the consequences of public safety.
Yeah, so, is that done anywhere that you know of?
A free T, no. Actually, most places on a public transportation, the price has gone up.
Right.
And, not us. Our fares have gone up, but not like 90% up.
Right.
And again, we are not a distance-based fare system. We are a flat fare system. Us in New York City, I believe the only two left in the U.S. and maybe globally that is strictly a flat fare system. Everyone is distance-based.
Okay. Okay.
So if I go from one stop to another, it's a cheaper fare from going one stop to 15 stops.
Yeah. Well, you know, it just makes sense, right? You're using the service for less amount of time than somebody who's using it more.
That's correct. And yeah. That creates it also addresses this issue regarding the concern about, you know, people living in inner cities trying to get to work.
Mm-hmm.
So the logic of the single fare system was when the T was really just Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of a single fare system is that it allows people to go to work without economic burdens. That was addressed in those cities that do this kind of fare-based system by trying to keep the fares close distance together, lower cost, because the theory is that at the time when these were built, you know, people live close to the workplaces inside the cities.
Yeah, that's why it was changed to the MBTA. It used to be the MTA. People in Western Mass are like, well, we're not getting anything out of this.
Yep, Bay Transit Authority, right?
Yeah.
So as times change, I mean, employment is now coming in from outside the city more, and people actually do leave the city for employment. And you know, again, the argument is that we shouldn't change to distance-based fare structure because it actually hurts inner city people who are lower section socioeconomic trying to get to work, even though they're traveling like, you know, a lot further in the T. So, you know, we actually did have a distance fare system, which was actually grossly unfair. Was when, you know, remember we had double fares at Braintree, Quincy Adams. And Quincy
Adams. Yep.
It was a triple fare at Braintree one time.
I think it was triple. I think you're right. Yeah.
I think that there was a double fare maybe at Al Wife, and I think it was a double fare at Riverside.
Yeah, yeah.
But nothing in the middle.
And then plus fare fee for parking also, you know, if you use the parking facility. Yeah.
So, I mean, they should have took, I mean, you know, obviously I didn't like that, like all the Quincy folks, because if you're going to do a distance-based fare, do a distance-based fare.
Mm-hmm.
Harvard Square, the same retreat in Quincy Center.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I only worked for Mike Morrissey at the time, and I was being a I kept yelling at him about this stuff, and they give me these map and just this ancient history at this point. No one needs to hear.
Yeah.
These people. But yeah, I mean, you know, there needs to be fare reform at some stage, and whether or not there's a political courage at the MBTA, they don't need us to do this at the legislative level. This is something is should be done at their level.
Yep.
About whether fare reform should be done. And that means have to buy a brand new system, because the Charlie card system is now starting to die.
Mm-hmm.
It's antiquated, it's old, and they do another RFP for a new system. And there's another question. Should we buy the cheapest thing possible, or should we spend more money and buy something more robust?
Mm.
Do taxpayers and fare payers want to spend more money?
Right. Yeah. All unanswered questions and unable to answer right now, you know, given what's going on. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. The T's a mess is basically the bottom line.
Okay. How about any good news from the State House, Tacky?
I never have good news. We've been together for like a year and a half now. When's the last time I gave you any good news?
Let's see. Well, did you go to the General's Bridge dedication ceremony this week, that weekend?
Yep, and I jumped out of my shoes when the cannons went off.
You and a lot of people.
Yeah, I wasn't aware about the cannons, really. It was actually an incredible dedication. I have to give a lot of credit to City Hall, the mayor, the councilors, the Parks Department, the police, everyone else, all the folks working on it. It was quite a really well done event.
Yeah, well, the bridge, people might not realize the bridge is actually a state project.
It is. This, I believe it was like $50-some-odd million of state money went to the bridge and the surrounding road system, plus smaller amounts of economic development money that the city's been getting over the past like decade plus in small amounts.
Yeah.
The city has gotten, you know, a few $100 million of state money for downtown over the course of 20 years.
Yep.
It just never came in one chunk sum. As I was talking to Michael Morrissey the other day, he reminded me, like, oh, remember when we got that money for this and that, like 10 million here, 5 million? I was like, yes, Michael, I know, I was there. I do remember that.
Yeah.
But the state delegations for 20 some odd years has been, pumping small amounts of money. And you're seeing the accumulation of a lot of stuff, including changing the underground utility system, which most of you don't even realize happened. We did a massive upgrade of the entire utility system underneath the city.
Yeah, you couldn't have any new development until that happened first, right?
Yeah, can you get electricity, telecommunications, water, a sewer, you remember, and actually also natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do a whole lot. So, you know, because of those massive infrastructure improvements that the state, you know, put up a portion of money for, allows that development. And but the event itself was phenomenally well done. I do have to say that. And the park is beautiful, and everybody should definitely take a quick drive down to check it out. And there's some new parking spaces up behind where the old Ross Garage is, an old parking way. It's not called the parking way anymore. But General's Way and so forth. So, it was quite remarkable. It was very much, it was wonderful. Did you guys cover that on QA TV?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we had it on here live, and soon folks will probably be able to see it on our website too.
Yeah, so everybody listening should, pop on the QA TV website and try to catch. You can't watch the whole thing. It went on for like 2.5+ hours. But
yeah,
definitely tune in and watch it, particularly the speeches from the generals and the generals' families.
Yeah, folks will enjoy it because they all reflected on growing up in their different neighborhoods in Quincy. So it'll be fun for the families, of course, to reflect on years to come.
Yeah, fast forward past, the politicians. And go straight to, that's what I like to do. Go straight to the family components. And I think people would very much enjoy that.
Yeah. Any update on the ballot questions, Tacky, for the next state election next year?
Signature gathering is currently going on.
Oh, okay.
So they have to get their signatures done, I think, sometime in November. And then once those signatures have been certified, they actually get admitted as bills in the House in January.
Gotcha. Okay.
So the ones that concern me the most as chair of the Committee on Consumer Protection and Professional Licensure is the ones regarding alcohol. Mm-hmm. So there's two bills out there, one regarding reinstating happy hours, and the other one to expand the number of retail licenses for beer and wine in retail, so package store licenses, so you can have more beer and wine licenses, places like supermarkets, convenience stores, beyond just liquor stores, as you see now. The current number of licenses any corporate entity can hold in Massachusetts for total number of beer and wine retail is 9.
Oh.
So this proposal it's a little bit intricate. There's a lot of things involved, but it's going to basically more than double that number slightly and hold harmless some other folks that have existing licenses. There's a few moving parts here, but not hurting people with licenses while expanding at the same time. It's a little intricate, plus some new pending mechanisms, enforcement mechanisms associated with it. So that was pushed out to Massachusetts Package Store Association, the current retailers, your favorite liquor store, put this initiative out there. And I have confirmed that they are actively collecting signatures. So this ballot question may be on my desk in the House probably the turn of the year.
Okay.
The other one regarding restoring happy hours. It's literally what it sounds like for those of us who actually know what a happy hour is, where you can sell half price alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
We banned that back, I was still a teenager at the time, so it must have been back in the late 80s.
I was just going to say, 87, but yeah, right, definitely.
I've been in middle school. Yep. So, like I said, most of us who remember the time, and I know I was really young, but I still remember it, sheer volume of deaths on the news every night from drunk driving, not at 3 in the morning.
Right.
These were after work hours.
Yep.
And it seemed like during that like time period, a lot of people knew somebody had died in a car accident. So, but there's a push to bring it back. In the committee, I have a bill that does a study to investigate the matter, not do a restoration. But I found out there is actually a bill coming also, not the ballot question, but a separate ballot, a second separate bill that's being filed to restore happy hours and a slew of other discount booze related issues.
Hmm.
Under the guise of helping out the restaurant industry. But I also remind everybody, not every restaurant has a liquor license.
Correct. Yep.
The majority of restaurants in the state do not have a liquor license, despite that we have a lot of liquor licenses up there. So, you know, it's a rather myopic view of the total hospitality industry. You know, it's just not booze. If you're only going to a restaurant that only serves booze all the time, then good for you. I go to places that have had no booze or do not have booze as well. And they are just fine too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some will allow you to bring your own beer or wine, you know, perhaps. But for the most part, you know, your small mom and pops, they don't. They don't have, they can't afford, you know, to invest in a liquor license.
Well, you walk down Wallace Center, where I am, there's a whole lot of restaurants now, and the majority of them do not have liquor licenses.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and they're smaller businesses that do just fine. So, I mean, I think there's a misnomer put up by the Boston Globe, in particular, giving the false impression that we only should say businesses with alcohol, because while they do not say out loud, the way they make it look like, well, we have to save these businesses, which are only alcohol businesses. I'm actually very troubled by this type of media.
Hmm.
Very much troubled by this type of media, because it's like the advertising, basically advertising in your articles about, you know, take out alcohol and how we have to save restaurants and we have to do more alcohol for restaurants and all these alcohol licensed restaurants need help. But they neglect to talk about, you know, I don't know, the other half of the industry that isn't alcohol driven.
Yeah, you have your sandwich shops, your pizza shops, your delis, your bakeries. Those are considered restaurants too, and they're mostly small family owned.
That's absolutely correct. You know, I think people need to understand the bigger picture as I, you know, to talk of the restaurant industry and among other industries I deal with. I mean, I am mindful of this kind of like moving dynamic of all these different types of industries coexisting together. And you know, we talk about, you know, alcohol licensing here on the podcast before regarding the valuation licenses and why the quota system exists. And like or hate it, it has actually huge economic impacts. You start changing the number of licenses on the quota system around. But, you know, I'm very mindful, you know, the fact that it's not just what you see in the newspapers or you see in the TV news or any Facebook article these days. Regarding the hospitality. I mean, I'm very conscientious of the fact that it's not just limited to one sector that gets media attention.
Yeah. Stay tuned for that as well. So by the end of the year, they have to have their signatures collected. Is that right?
Liquor questions have to get passed round one of signature collection by year's end, or basically by end of November.
Okay.
They'll be certified, and then they'll be admitted in the house.
Okay. All right. Anything else we should let folks know about right now?
Well, it's the fall time. And
yes.
You know, or is it the fall time? It's hard to tell.
It's the new fall, right? Exactly. It's 80 degrees and muggy now in fall instead of 60 and sunny.
Yeah, it's hard to tell what weather in these days, right? You know, I think the only thing I tell folks is that COVID numbers are rising, the highest numbers we've seen since vaccinations really got to a high level back in early July. Not surprising, as we reopen more and more, the infection rate goes up. But also to remind folks that, you know, people with these so-called breakthrough cases see light in news are still the minority. It is under 1% of Massachusetts residents that are breakthrough case. I think it's like 0.61 currently.
It's gone up a little bit, but yeah, it's you're right. It's under 1%, definitely. Under 1%.
Yeah. And deaths were like, I think under 200 total of vaccinated people. And we've been saying over and over again, the vaccines are not 100% immunity. I hate when people say I'm immune because I've gotten COVID or I have a vaccine. There is no immunity. I mean, I wish people would stop saying that.
Yeah.
What you have is you have a lower probability of becoming severely ill,
right?
Or perhaps dying. And people who had a past sadly also had other serious underlying medical conditions.
Yeah.
Also, tend to be older. Which again goes back to the issue of mask wearing and the fact you be conscientious around other people, and you got to think about not yourself, because I worry about more about my mom than I worry about me, to take care of my mom requires me to be vaccinated and also try to do my best when I'm not in the house to maintain social distancing somewhat best I can. I do wear masks indoors more than ever. Outdoors, I still feel fairly safe, and I still keep my distance the best I can when I'm outdoors. But I mean, I'm worried about her more than myself. And I think that's very important. So, I mean, very small number of breakthrough cases, despite what the media looks like. Nationally, it's also very small. There's this booster shot coming up. You saw in the news, people who have high health risk are up first. But, you know, if you had unpleasant first two shots, and I did too, you know, it's not going to discourage me from whenever I come up on the list, perhaps down the road, in priority to get that third shot. And I will endure some discomfort versus the alternative. And, I won't name the hospital, but we have a friend, actually one of my mom's better friends, I do, who's 95 and has reaching kind of that age, right? You're 95. And there's a lot of health issues associated with that. And he's at a hospital right now in ICU where they need to see if they can move him along because they need ICU new beds for COVID.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
So this is real for those of us who know people who do not have COVID and need an ICU bed. So, people don't think it can happen to you. You don't know happening to someone you know or you love. You're wrong, because it's unless you're oblivious to it, not caring, it does. This is the reality, and the people that are in ICU beds aren't vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So numbers are up, and not surprising. Coincide reopening, the more vaccinations, breakthrough cases will occur. Again, it's not 100% immunity, but there could be more breakthrough cases. But it's still far, far lower for people who are vaccinated and breakthrough cases that are hospitalized or die versus people who are not vaccinated, who have a higher case of hospitalizations and die by a vast amount.
Yeah. The whole goal is to end the pandemic status of this. It's not ever going to go away, but just to end the pandemic aspect of it, you know.
Well, controllability is depending on all of us to be, you know, controllability isn't done by the hospital system. Controllability is done by us. I mean, this idea we can keep it under control is not a government function. Keep it under control is actually the population's function.
You have the power.
You have the power in your own hands to make a decision of how to take care of other people.
Right.
It's up to you to decide how you want to do it.
Yeah, and good way to put it, Jackie. Yep.
I've said this a lot all through the year, but then the numbers are real. And it's, like I said, it's not surprising. It coincides with the opening of the economy fully. And the numbers have gone up in terms of infection rates and deaths, particularly, especially among unvaccinated people. This is not a surprise. I mean, we saw it before last September. We did a partial reopening and numbers went bonkers. Again, we saw that during people going to the Cape in large numbers. And we saw it again. There was a spike. So I don't, I'm trying to tell you, folks, I don't see a massive cliff decline like we did when vaccinations began. You kind of got this gradual decline when vaccinations began and just kind of fell off the cliff, so to speak, when it got to a high vaccination, infection rates went down, but now it's climbing, and I don't see another scenario where it's like just a sudden drop.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think we're over 66% fully vaccinated. We're about 76%, so about 10% difference on first doses. Those of you who are still on the first dose, please get the second. I know some folks who only got one dose. They're partially vaccinated. They do have some strong, resistance antibodies, but the second one, particularly against Delta, will be much better, much, much better.
Yeah.
Of course, if doom and gloom tacky, there will be another variant. I think that's no surprise to anybody at this point. The question is when and where.
Right. On that happy note, I'll ask you to give out your contact information to Tacky.
Yeah, it's for those of you who wants more doom and gloom, I guess, you can call us at the office at 617-722-2014, 722-2014, hit any button, you get a staff and leave a voicemail. I do understand we actually had very high calls over the past week, and there's been a bit of a delay getting back to people because it's just volume now. But we had an unusually high number of calls. So I do understand. I've heard from some constituents that took a little longer to get back than we normally do. But that's high call volume issue. Of course, you can email me at tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. My email is full, as we talked about earlier, about all the people looking how to spend federal money, among other things that show up in my email box. You know, there's the Tacky Chan Facebook page, State Representative Tacky Chan. You don't have to be my friend to see my Facebook, folks.
Okay.
Don't be my friend. But I mean, like, put the public hearings, for example, online there. So you can see what my public hearings look like, as well as information. Like, you know, when Ida came through, we put storm information up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, as well as tackychin.org, which is more of a resource page for people to get like phone numbers for places that are important that may come and help to you. But of course, you know, tune to QATV you know, not just to see my gloomy face with Joe here.
As if that weren't enough, Tacky.
But to, you know, obviously, you know, hear from other folks beyond me, like the mayor, the, you know, Council President Liang and all these other folks that provide information and perhaps have a different point of view of how the world works than I do.
We try and be of equal opportunity to let folks use our service. Absolutely. So, and we appreciate that you do.
Absolutely. And I'll catch you another week or so.
All right. Thanks, Tacky. Be well.
Thank you, Joe. Talk to you soon.